I'm not going to be speaking from what you might call a neutral position, although I'm not going to speak from a biased position either. What I mean by that is that the key challenges that I'm going to be concerned about are how do we improve the pharmaceutical development and regulatory system in order to maximise the interests of public health? While some people might think that's controversial, actually it's not really controversial, because if you assert the proposition that the point of having a pharmaceutical industry and the point of having pharmaceuticals is in fact to provide advancement for patients' health and public health, there are very few people anywhere in the whole sector, whether it's in companies, whether it's in government, whether it's patient groups, or etc., who will publicly declare that they disagree with that. What they say privately, of course, is different. And for those of you who heard Mike Rowland's talk last night, of course, those of us who look at these things or even just read the newspapers, we know that the pharmaceutical industry is of economic importance in certain sorts of economic ways, in terms of various economic criteria, export revenues, tax revenues, and so on. Whilst that is the case, publicly, nobody, as far as I can tell, will declare that that should override the fundamental health purposes of pharmaceuticals and the pharmaceutical industry. So the idea that pharmaceuticals and the pharmaceutical industry are supposed to be improving health is the prior and fundamental purpose of these activities. So therefore, when you realise that, that's not all quite as complex as Tim was saying, in the sense that you can take that as your baseline and you can say, okay, that's our goal. How well are these systems doing in achieving that goal? And so my key challenges are in the sense that actually there are shortcomings in the system, and the challenges are to overcome those shortcomings, improve them in order to reach those health goals that I mentioned. The other thing I'll say by way of introduction is that we had Mike Rowlands here last night giving his talk, and his talk was about various things, but a lot of the discussion was about NICE, and so I'm not going to talk about NICE, which is how we regulate cost effectiveness. I'm going to talk about the stage before that, which is how we regulate pharmaceuticals in order to decide whether or not they're safe and effective enough to go on the market in the first place. What NICE does is a subsequent rule, which is to say, once the licensing authority has decided that it can go on the market, is it cost effective for the NHS? That's what NICE does. That's a later stage in the process. I'm looking at the earlier stage. Okay, so...
Can we go on full screen?
Oh, yes, of course. Where is the...
The left-hand corner.
Where's the... Oh, this is the mouse. Okay, here we go.
Yes, that's right. Hit it. No.
Good. And this table?
There. Yep. Click.
It's like the golden shot, isn't it? Right. So, this is what I'm going to talk about in outline. First of all, I'm going to talk about innovation and therapeutic advance, what these things mean. Then I'm going to talk about, as a consequence of a misunderstanding about what's been happening in relation to innovation and therapeutic advance, how safety standards were loosened and streamlined. Then I'm going to talk about what the post-hoc political rationalisation for that process was in terms of evaluating drugs for safety. Then I'm going to sort of shift gears slightly and talk about a different kind of pharmaceutical regulation, which are called accelerated approval mechanisms. And by that stage, you'll have realised there are lots of problems with pharmaceutical development and regulation. Then we're going to talk about why do these problems persist? Why does the system not learn? And at that point, I'll talk about things like the independence of regulatory agencies, their public accountability, and so on. Okay, so if you don't work in this area, it's quite reasonable that you would be confused about pharmaceutical innovation, because when people talk about innovation generally, whether it's to the media or whether it's at conferences, they will very, very rarely define what they mean. But the term is imbued with an apparent positive flavour. But it's not defined. However, if you work in this area, you very quickly realise exactly what pharmaceutical innovation means, because the government regulatory agencies, the industry, and the specialists in the sector have a very clear definition of what it is. Pharmaceutical product innovation is defined as new molecular entities which reach the market. What's a new molecular entity? A new molecular entity is a sort of technically unique chemical or compound which can be patented. Right? So we have a definition of innovation, of pharmaceutical innovation, and this is how innovation is then quantified, because we count the number of pharmaceutical product innovations that the industry produces in a particular country, say, and so on. So pharmaceutical product innovation is defined by patentable new molecular entities that can come to the market. Now, the first thing you notice about this definition is it has no relationship to health at all. It's an entirely commercial definition. Whether something is patentable is a commercial thing. It's about intellectual property rights. Whether something reaches the market or not, again, is a commercial factor. The health aspect only comes in because in order to get onto the market, there is a government regulatory agency to determine whether or not the pharmaceutical is safe or effective. But right across the world, government drug regulatory agencies do not determine whether or not a new molecular entity offers therapeutic advance or not as a condition to put it on the market. They only have to prove that it's safe and effective relative to placebo. So the regulatory agencies do not insist that innovation means therapeutic advance. And indeed, within the entire system, innovation does not mean therapeutic advance. It might do, but it often doesn't. One of the things that's been happening over some decades now is that the rate of innovation, the number of new molecular entities coming onto markets, has been declining. So, for instance, there were 21 in the US in 2003, but there were 53 in 1996. And this slide shows the decline between 93 and 2003. There's also biological licensing applications. These are bigger molecules, biologicals as they're called. But the new molecular entities clearly falling. They're both falling, in fact. And this is the sort of innovation or productivity crisis within the pharmaceutical industry that people have been talking about. Now, we know from the United States Food and Drug Administration, that's the US drug regulatory agency, what proportion, according to their standards, what proportion of new molecular entities do offer therapeutic advance. They estimate only 40% of new molecular entities that come onto the US market offer significant therapeutic advance. And these are given by the FDA, these are given priority review when they're submitted to the FDA to decide whether they should go on the market. So we had 18 of these in 1996 and just 9 in 2003. So the number of new molecular entities offering therapeutic advance is also declining. Incidentally, some people, who might be labelled critics of the system, I suppose, think that the FDA's assessment of the industry's products that offer significant therapeutic advance is far too generous. So they claim it's only 10%, like Prescrire, which is a French organisation of medical professionals and pharmacists and so on. Just to give you an indication of how little importance drug regulatory agencies in some parts of the world give to distinguishing between innovation, which is a fundamentally commercially defined phenomenon, and therapeutic advance, the European Union's regulatory agency and the UK regulatory agency don't even routinely collect data to make this distinction. At least, if the European Union does, it won't tell anybody that it does it and provide the information. The UK, when questioned about this by Parliament, said, "No, we don't collect the data, and we see no need to." And the consequence of this, of course, is the regulatory policies are framed around measures and an analysis of innovation, not drugs that offer therapeutic advance. Strange if the goal is health. Here we see the decline in new molecular entities differentiated according to priority drugs, the ones that offer significant therapeutic advance, and standard drugs. And you can see that actually the area that's falling most, which is the yellow ones, are the priority drugs. So we've got a decline in drugs that offer therapeutic advance significantly as well. And this is more up to date. This takes us up to 2007. So the trend of decline is not... There was, some people were saying genetics and genomics was going to turn all this around. People were saying that about 10 years ago, and so far there's certainly no evidence for that. Although admittedly there is some lag time, so... Okay. So we have the productivity crisis. This is a very vocal crisis. The industry is saying we're not getting our innovation done because the narrative that is developed out of the productivity crisis, which goes way back to the early 90s, this narrative began in the early 90s, was that the reason that we're not getting enough new molecular entities out there, enough innovation, is because the regulatory system is too heavy. There's too much regulation. So the consequence of this was to form various sorts of organisations. The most important was the International Conference on Harmonisation of Drug Regulatory Standards across the US, Japan and the European Union, the three biggest markets. And this organisation was tasked with essentially streamlining the regulatory standards for the industry in terms of how much testing they had to do, how much data they had to provide to demonstrate that their drugs were safe and effective. And the safety standards largely were loosened and reduced. And we can see this here. These are just some examples of the standards for the ICH standards for non-life-threatening illnesses. So instead of having a requirement of that it was necessary to have clinical trials included in the submission of at least 1 year duration, this was cut to just 6 months. despite the fact that there was evidence that about one quarter of serious adverse drug reactions occurred the second 6 months of that 1 year period. And more importantly, 1/8 of adverse drug reactions reported in clinical trials first occurred in that second 6 months. So that 1/8 of adverse drug reactions now would just not be detected. These are just a few examples. I mean, the ICH documents are huge, so I can only give you a flavour. Another example is that it's known that patients would be exposed on clinical trials for more than 6 months some of the time. Yet ICH determined that if somebody was exposed continuously to a drug for more than 6 months, they were at carcinogenic risk from that drug. In other words, they were at risk that the drug might cause cancer. But despite this, they didn't require the carcinogenicity testing in animals to be completed before the clinical trial went beyond 6 months. In other words, the company would, because of this standard, the company would be permitted to conduct carcinogenicity testing in animals concurrently with doing clinical trials, but the company wouldn't know whether the drug caused cancer in animals whilst patients were taking the drug. And you might say, to add insult to injury, that's injury in quotes, so we don't know for sure what injuries might be caused by this. The long-term carcinogenicity testing standard in animals itself was reduced from two species to one, which reduced the capacity of the testing system to detect trans-species carcinogens, which, of course, are the crucial ones in terms of human health and patients' health, because if a carcinogen is going to produce cancer in a number of animal species, then it's more likely that it will extrapolate from, say, a rat to a person. So we have these sorts of streamlining and loosening of the standards. Now, how was this then rationalised by the regulators, the pharmaceutical industry, and in general the system of controlling pharmaceuticals? Well, it was rationalised by erecting an entirely novel principle, which I don't think is justified, which is why I refer to it here as myths, which is that basically when we're looking at whether or not a new drug should go on the market or not, it's really only once the drug's out there on the market being given to patients in the post-marketing phase, that's the only time that you can really work out whether it's safe or not. The pre-market testing can't really tell you very much. This was the narrative of rationalisation for loosening the pre-market testing process. And so there were various people who tried to sort of make the case that actually, you know, that it's impossible to detect most safety problems pre-market, at the pre-market stage of regulation. But actually our research showed that if you looked in detail at many of the drug disasters, drugs that had to be withdrawn from the market and so on, and you looked at what could have been detected in the pre-marketing phase, many of the reasons for those drugs having to be withdrawn from the market on safety grounds were detectable from the pre-market data. They weren't detected, but they were detectable. And we looked at, for example, we compared all the drugs withdrawn in the UK and the US between 1971 and 1992, withdrawn for safety reasons. And we found that, and the UK had many more drugs withdrawn for safety reasons than the US. And we found that the US Drug Regulatory Agency, the FDA, was able to, it refused to approve 40% of the UK drug safety withdrawals. It refused to let them onto the US market for precisely the reasons that the UK subsequently had to withdraw them. So the FDA, and it detected them at the pre-marketing stage, because we also had to control for the fact that some of the drugs went on the UK market before they went on the US market. So the US had access to post-marketing information about the UK in some cases. But we controlled for that. We took account of that. And we are only counting the cases that were detected by the FDA pre-market from their pre-market assessment. So the idea that was put forward by publications from many regulators, many people from the industry, many other commentators, that actually we don't need rigorous pre-market safety assessment because it doesn't make any difference, that really you can only learn at the post-marketing phase, we demonstrated that that's just wrong. The other thing about this rationalisation narrative that was highly suspect, and I'm putting it in the past tense, but many, many people still believe this within the system. But anyway, the thing that was also suspect comes back to this problem about distinguishing between innovation and therapeutic advance. So during this period of the 1990s and indeed the 1980s as well, many commentators in the UK and Europe, where drugs were going in the market earlier than the US, many commentators were arguing, yes, there's many more new molecular entities, i.e. innovation, is happening in the UK and the European Union than in the US. So the US FDA, it's being too rigorous a regulator, so it's blocking innovation in the US. And so the argument was used that we don't want to have that sort of model. We want the much more looser model. And so the ICH, the International Conference on Harmonisation, shifted the FDA to this looser model, shifted Sweden and many other countries to a looser model. And all of this argument was based on what was happening to innovation, counting all the new molecular entities, right? But let's do a different analysis. As some researchers, they took panels from France and the United States of pharmacists, medical experts, clinicians, and so on, and they said to them, okay, identify in this 18-year period, 1970-1988, identify the most therapeutically important drugs that were put on the market in this period. So they came up with, collectively agreed on 34 most therapeutically significant drugs marketed in the G7 countries and Switzerland. And they found that if you look at those drugs, the FDA marketed those drugs, it marketed more of those drugs more quickly than the UK did or many other countries. In fact, the FDA ranked third best out of the eight in getting those drugs onto the market fastest. Standard drugs that offered no therapeutic advance might even be less effective than drugs already in the market. It took a long time. So that's bad for innovation as it is strictly defined. Does it matter for health? So the consequence of this finding is that you realise that actually deciding about how to frame regulatory policy based on what's happening to innovation can be very misleading. It also shows, I think, that thinking about the FDA, it shows, I mean, something that Michael Rollins talked about last night about social values being important in pharmaceutical regulation, or as he put it, politics with a small p. Well, I think from a social scientist point of view, what this shows very importantly is that if you think about the FDA in that period, in that, you know, 1970s, 1980s, early 1990s, it was being more rigorous and strict about letting drugs through in terms of safety. But what that also shows is that it was being rigorous in differentiating between drugs according to effectiveness as well. And this gives you a consistent picture, which is actually about the political culture of that regulatory organisation. That the political culture of that regulatory organisation was prioritising health criteria more than other criteria, and more than the UK was, for instance. So that I think is the correct analysis of what was going on in that period, rather than this rationalisation about you can only find out what's going on with drugs in the post-marketing phase. However, let us, you know, because I'm a very self-critical person. So let's suppose that all the research that we've done about that to show that narrative was false. Let's suppose that I'm completely wrong about that. And actually, the narrative that you can only really find out whether a drug is safe or not is once it's out there in the market being used in everyday practice and so on, and that pre-marketing testing isn't really very important. You know, it's a first-line kind of screen, but you can't really find very much out. Let's suppose that narrative is correct. Wouldn't you then expect ICH, which is this organisation that brings together the regulators and industry from Japan, the European Union and the US, wouldn't you expect them, having loosened the pre-marketing testing batteries and standards, wouldn't you expect them then to tighten up the post-marketing ones? Isn't that the thing you'd expect them to do, given their narrative? Well, what do? They loosen the post-marketing surveillance as well. So, for example, they drop the requirement for expedited reporting of expected serious adverse drug reactions. In other words, they harmonized. They looked at all the countries that had different ways of doing this, and they harmonized down to the lowest common denominator. In other words, the one that had the least strict safety, post-marketing safety requirements. And what this change meant, for instance, is that if a drug goes on the market and it's prescribed a lot very rapidly, because the companies are not required to produce expedited reporting of expected adverse drug reactions, you can't quantify The regulators don't have the information to quantify how many adverse drug reactions of that expected type are happening so that they can compare that quantity with other drugs and make a rational decision about how safe it is relative to other products. They don't have that information anymore. So something like Viagra, for instance, about 1 million prescriptions in the US alone in the first 6 weeks on the market. What they also did was they permitted companies to submit periodic safety update reviews to regulators every 6 months instead of every three. That's obviously a lowering of the standard. And in fact, what we're finding in some cases, and of course Vioxx would be one example of this, but there are other examples, is that post-marketing surveillance is sometimes of such a poor standard in detecting these problems that actually, and post-marketing surveillance, what the regulators will tell you is that it's an early warning system, right? But actually what we're finding quite often is that the courts act as a late warning system. So patients take companies to court, all sorts of data gets released into the court system, and then we find out about safety problems that the regulators didn't even know about. So you know, I'm not saying that's what happens all the time, but that's happening some of the time. And if we hadn't loosened all the standards in the first place, many of these difficulties might not be with us. Okay. What I've been talking about up to now mostly is what we would call the standard approval process, which is what is used for all new molecular entities in general. However, since the mid-80s, gradually there has evolved a different regulatory medicine called, in the US it's called accelerated approval, in Europe it's called exceptional circumstances. And what these are basically about is regulatory standards which are lower than the standard approval system, and they're lower, but they're only for drugs that are, initially it was just life-threatening, in fact initially it was just for AIDS, HIV/AIDS, then it was extended to cancer, then it was extended to life-threatening diseases, now it's been extended to serious and life-threatening diseases. But basically, if you're developing a drug to go on the market to treat a serious or life-threatening disease, you can apply to be considered under accelerated approval mechanisms, which mean you need to meet lesser standards of data to be submitted, which I'll talk about in a bit of detail in a moment. But I do, again, just want to pause to try and get the history of this right. And social scientists are as much to blame about getting this wrong as regulators or the industry or anybody else. Many people have presented the emergence of accelerated approval regulations as being a consequence of AIDS patient activism, or in some cases cancer patient activism. But actually that just isn't true. I'm sorry, it's just historically false. There's no question that AIDS and AIDS patient activism in the US, you know, for the AIDS patients, for example, occupied the FDA building in 1988. I know this because I was doing my PhD fieldwork in the FDA on the same day. and it was a strange, it was a very strange day with riot police and all the rest of it. AIDS patient activists, riot police, and I'm just trying to look at my documents in there. But anyway, there's no doubt that that had some kind of influence, but it came later. Actually, the Reagan administration and its Republican deregulatory agenda started in 1985, and just before 1985, it was putting pressure on the FDA to do various things that would make it easier for drugs to get on the market with less data and more rapidly. I haven't got time to go into all the detail. But there were regulations put in place to change the standard required for life-threatening diseases well before AIDS activism, to accelerate drug approval by the FDA. And that was all about the arguments I was talking about earlier. And it was led by the industry, and it was led by the Republican administration under Reagan, which is about regarding the FDA as a bureaucratic, over-regulating, big government obstacle to innovation. That predated the AIDS activists. The AIDS activists did have some effect, but they fitted into this broader political movement and framework, and it was a very nice alliance for the deregulatory community in the US. And you can also see why the AIDS activists weren't as important as many people have claimed, because very quickly the regulatory changes weren't just about AIDS anymore. As soon as it happened for AIDS, the industry said, oh, well, let's do it for cancer as well. Let's do it for diabetes. Let's do it for arthritis. Let's maximize the market share where you can actually get drugs on the market where you don't have to do so much testing in these areas and get them onto the market faster. And so the accelerated approval and so-called exceptional circumstances in Europe, it's called, these aspects of regulation, which started out, from so far as the AIDS patient groups were concerned, started out being this hugely exceptional thing that actually, you know, if you've got HIV, AIDS, and there's nothing to treat you, yeah, give us, you know, any of these drugs that are even being tried out, you know, because we need something, there's nothing. So that was a hugely exceptional circumstance. But that very rapidly changed within the regulatory system to being all these other areas. So we now have a situation in which 15% of new molecular entities go through the accelerated approval mechanism in the US and 14% in the European Union. It's not that exceptional. It's not the majority, but it's not that exceptional. Now, what does this mean, the fact that it means less data? Well, what it can mean, for example, is that instead of having what are called the randomized controlled phase 3 trials that happen before a drug is considered to go on the market, there might not be any data of that kind at all. There'll just be perhaps a small trial, which we call phase 2 data. It might not be a double-blind trial. It might not be randomized. There might not even be any control group. It might just be a single arm. You know, so for cancer drugs, where there is an unmet need, in other words, for example, patients who have tried first-line treatment and second-line treatment and haven't responded, a drug can be developed for third-line cancer treatment, in which there's no active placebo group. There's just a single-arm trial of patients, and it can be a small trial. The other thing that can be used in this accelerated approval is what we call surrogate endpoints. Now, surrogate endpoints in themselves, if they're established, are not necessarily a bad thing for health. So blood pressure, for instance, is a surrogate endpoint for the risk of strokes. That's an established surrogate endpoint for strokes. And that seems to make sense. CD4 cell counts for HIV and AIDS is an established surrogate endpoint for the progression of the HIV AIDS disease. The problem arises when we have non-established surrogate endpoints, and what the accelerated approval mechanisms permit the drug companies to do is to get their drugs onto the market based on evidence that a non-established surrogate endpoint is likely to predict a clinical outcome. So, for example, tumour shrinkage in cancer is a non-established surrogate endpoint for increasing the patient's survival. And the consequence of allowing these surrogate endpoints is that, how do I get rid of this? Okay. So the consequence of permitting these surrogate endpoints within the regulatory system is that the companies are then required under the accelerated approval to do a post-marketing proper randomized controlled trial to confirm that the surrogate endpoint does indeed produce the clinical outcome. So in the case of cancer, if they show that there's some tumor shrinkage as a surrogate endpoint, the drug is allowed onto the market so the cancer patients can get it, but then post-market they have to do a randomized controlled trial to demonstrate that it does improve survival or some other clinical outcome like symptom improvement perhaps. And these are called post-marketing confirmatory studies. So the first thing you notice about this is that the decision about whether or not the drug is effective or not is pushed to the post-marketing phase. Finally working out whether the drug is effective or not is pushed to the post-marketing phase rather than the decision being made about before it goes on the market. This allows a number of things to happen. It allows the company to effectively market the drug to the medical profession, effectively market the drug to patients, often through things called expanded access programs where they get where patients are given the drug outside clinical trials, outside any sort of controlled experimental setting. So then the question is, what happens if in the post-marketing phase the company either doesn't do the confirmatory trial, because the company is now able to sell the drug commercially and make money from it. What happens if it doesn't do the confirmatory trial that it's supposed to? Or what happens when it does the confirmatory trial and the confirmatory trial shows no clinical benefit? Well, the bad news is that since the accelerated approval regulations were introduced in 1992, the US Food and Drug Administration hasn't withdrawn a single drug product which has failed to confirm its surrogate endpoint. And not only that, even if it takes the company 10 or more years to do the confirmatory trial, the FDA does not withdraw the product because there has not been due diligence to demonstrate the clinical endpoint. And so, for example, in the last decade or so in the US, companies completed post-marketing confirmatory studies in just 25% of the products that were approved through accelerated approval system. The projected time for post-marketing confirmatory studies for cancer drugs is about 10 years. And no sanctions due to industry non-compliance. There have been no sanctions, no FDA withdrawals. And in fact, when the legislation was being debated, a number of patient groups wanted there to be a fine on companies if they didn't comply with this, but the industry managed to prevent that from being passed. So the only sanction there is for the FDA to withdraw the product. But they've never done that, ever. So, again, not just on the safety side, but now on the efficacy side, when we look at these accelerated approval regulations, what we've effectively got is, yes, these drugs can get onto the market faster, patients can get access to them faster, but what we have got, in effect, is a lower regulatory standard for drugs to treat the most serious and life-threatening diseases that patients have. And the process by which we're supposed to confirm that they are actually effective clinically is very poorly applied. So we've got problems with what's happened to the safety standards, and we've got problems with what's happening to efficacy standards. I mean, the other thing about the accelerated approval standards on efficacy is that it makes it more difficult for clinicians and doctors to know how to use the drug when they're trying to give it to patients, because they don't have enough data about how to compare it with other drugs. But the problem, as these accelerated approval regulatory problems continue over time, this gets worse and worse. Because if you think about it, the comparative standard for the new drug is now lower than previously, because as you have drugs approved onto the market under these lower standards of accelerated approval, they become the benchmark against future drug development to be compared. So it's not just about in thinking about the risk-benefit or benefit-benefit trade-off. I mean, think this is more about benefit-benefit trade-off, actually. The benefit-benefit trade-off for drugs under the accelerated approval regulatory system, it's not just about what are the benefits or disbenefits for the patients who might access that drug. There's also a wider public health benefit issue about lowering the regulatory standards for these types of drugs in general. So we shouldn't just think about it in terms of the patient groups who might benefit from getting quick access to that particular drug. There's also the implications for the wider public health and patient groups. Okay, so, well, as a social scientist or as a political scientist, political sociologist, whatever you want to call me, why might we have all these problems with our regulatory system in relation to advancing and benefiting health? Well, here are some ideas. I can't go into the details and prove them and all that sort of thing, but here are some ideas. Regulatory agencies have increasingly, in roughly in the same sort of period, become dependent on fees from companies to do their regulatory work. So you can see this, for example, this is the percentage of industry fee contribution to the European Medicines Evaluation Agency, which is the EU's drug regulatory agency, and FDA. We can see a very clear increase. It's pretty much staying the same as it was in 2006 now. But basically, the regulatory agencies, the staff, their resources for doing drug regulation are all now largely dependent on fees from companies. And because of the context in which these regulatory agencies find themselves working, they are to some extent in competition with each other to attract these industry fees. And the reason for that is that in the European system, the fees are awarded to different rapporteurs from different agencies. It's essentially a network system which draws on experts from the different national regulatory agencies. So within Europe, there is to some extent an internal competition. So far as the US is concerned, the pressure to keep the fees coming in from industry is determined by the fact that the US Congress looks at the FDA every 5 years to determine how much of the federal budget it will spend on the FDA. And the federal government doesn't want to spend very much on the FDA if it can avoid it. Therefore, it wants the FDA to keep up its contributions from industry fees. And the industry know this. And the industry know what I've just said about the European system as well. So the industry has a lot of leverage for this reason over the agenda of the regulatory agencies. Okay, I'm being told to stop. So, what this implies is a lot of the change in the political culture of the regulatory agencies, where the companies are regarded as the customers of the regulatory agencies. Regulatory agencies see the industry as their customers. The consequence of the acceleration of the regulatory process, both the standard process and the accelerated approval process for serious and life-threatening disease drugs, this means that there are less checks on industry data because there's less time for the regulators to do the work. This means putting more trust in the industry data analysis, and effectively this means that there's more chance of the regulators have less confidence in taking action against the companies because they have a less thorough evidence base to do so. There are also problems of conflicts of interest of expert advisors who advise the regulatory agencies. This is a frequent problem across many regulatory agencies. The worst one is one drug I looked at where 10 out of 11 of the expert advisors had interest in the drug that was being considered by the advisory committee. But, you know, there are lots of problems that one could argue about that. And I would suggest that if we were going to maximise the interests of public health, we would not permit people to have conflicts of interest while they're on the committee. Secrecy is a big problem, something alluded to yesterday in Mike Rowland's talk. This is a much bigger problem in Europe than it is in the US. I won't go into the details, but we have this thing called the European Public Assessment Reports on drugs that are approved onto the European market. But these don't provide that much detail, and they're entirely discretionary. You don't have public rights of access to information beyond them, necessarily. I will just say one thing about why secrecy can have a big impact, and actually NICE is the nicest example of this, because NICE did a review of the published literature on antidepressants and their safety in children, and concluded from that they were safe, the SSRI antidepressants were safe for children. Then they managed to get hold of the unpublished data as well, and they put that together with the published data, and they reached exactly the opposite conclusion. So public access to regulatory science and decision-making is crucial. The argument that this can't be done because of intellectual property rights is bogus, because patents are awarded usually at the latest by the end of phase two trials, which is way before the randomised control trials of phase three will be completed, so way before the drug goes in the market. And we don't have enough legislative oversight of what's going on with the regulatory agencies, how they're performing. So the House of Commons 2005 hearings that I was centrally involved in, that was the first time that the UK Parliament had looked in detail at the British drug regulatory system for 90 years. NICE, admittedly, has been looked at a few times by itself, but that's a different, NICE is different. NICE is the NHS and cost effectiveness. But the stuff I'm talking about hasn't been looked at since 1914. And I'll stop there because I've been told to stop.
First of all, thank you for the invitation to come and participate in this meeting. Yeah, so first of all, and in the light of those advisory committee appointments, a disclaimer, I sit in government advisory committees, I am one of these regulators, and so anything about a particular product, I must refer you to the chairman of the committee, because that's procedure. On the other hand, I'm a thinking, sentient human being who's been spending 17 years doing this, and so I take full responsibility for my opinions, reflections on process. What I want to do is, you had a framework of about five different points, and I want to make a comment on each of those. And then I've got a couple of more general points I want to pull out. And my thing is really to get discussion going. That's what I see my role as. I absolutely accept your premise. I think that's a very useful one to work from, that the pharmaceutical industry, essentially, if there's any point to it, it's to improve the public health of patients. I'd also say, actually, if there's any point to a regulatory system, it's exactly that as well. I mean, obviously, it gets you invitations to talk and nice dinners and all the rest of it. But, yeah, I mean, essentially, that is also there to improve the public health. The first notion you picked up on is the idea of therapeutic advance. And I think it would be a lovely idea if every drug that came through represented a serious therapeutic advance. But I'm more relaxed than you are that that's not the case. And I think it's because there's different aspects to it. I mean, one is market supply. If something comes along which is more or less as good as something else, it may not be a significant therapeutic advance. But if that company goes under or some unexpected safety aspect comes up, if you've only got one drug on the market, then the NHS can be hostage to fortune. So, or held hostage. Or if there's, sometimes we've seen with drugs where there is only one, suddenly there's a quality issue comes up, and we've sometimes sat there and said, well, this has not met the quality standard, but if we don't release it, there is nothing else that these patients can do. And so that's an important, more general consideration. Generics, I mean, I've spent too much of my life licensing generics, which are essentially me too's. But again, you know, they've got an important role in bringing price down. I mean, Mike Warner's last night talked about, you know, a lot of things NICE don't want to give money to or approve. Essentially, part of the problem is the price. And, you know, for all their faults, generics do help bring those down. So, again, they're not a therapeutic advance, but they broaden the market in a more general sense. The other time therapeutic advance does come into it. You can't, under UK legislation, you have to look at safety and efficacy in an absolute sense, but risk-benefit is also a consideration. And some you can actually then look at, if something is a therapeutic advance, you may take, or it's the only, perhaps the only new drug, then risk, it does begin to play in. But we're not in a comparative system. The idea is we put it on the market, and I think actually NICE has clarified that, because NICE then make these judgments. And the other question is that licensing, and there is this, as you've alluded to, and I'll come back to, tension between licensing things early to give patients access to them, but waiting until you've got all the data. Usually at the point of licensing, those head-to-head trials simply have not been done. And I think there's a really important question about whose job it is to actually do the, fund those head-to-head trials. And again, I'll come back to the funding of some things that don't fall within the regulatory system. So I agree with you up to a point, but I think it's more subtle than perhaps you gave it credit for. Another thing you touched on is the independence. And again, double-edged sword, because if you're squeaky clean but know nothing about the area, you can make very naive judgments. On the other hand, and I think in the paper you sent me, you used the word revolving door, one of the conflicts. There are direct conflicts where people perhaps have shares in GSK or they've got a lifelong interest in you because they've been involved in the development of that drug. But also, there's some people are not easy about the fact that a lot of assessors within the agency have worked in the industry before, a lot of them go out there and are clearly kind of, enhanced salaries to go into the industry. But on the other hand, there are also the people who are aware of the sharpest practice. Often it's only someone who's worked in the industry that says, well, actually, I'm not trusting that statistical analysis because I think they'll have come at it like this. Or somebody who understands the industry said, well, actually, they did it against that standard, but that's actually a suboptimal standard. Whereas, us public people sit there and just don't see this kind of thing at all. So there's a real tension between knowledge. And you talked about the committee where, 10 of the experts had interest in that thing. There are some areas where you cannot find experts who don't have interest. I mean, there are other areas where there's a great deal of choice, but there are some where, I see the people within the MHRA tearing their hair out, and, they said, I went to every name you gave me, and we can't have them because they're seriously conflicted, and not just declarable interest, but so expertise versus interest is a really difficult one. You talked about safety monitoring. You sort of gave the impression that in some ways the market, the looking at safety standards have gone down. I think there's one really positive development in the European framework that you didn't mention, and that's what's called the risk management plan. So what's behind that is that until relatively recently, the general cycle of a drug was that a company bought it, it got a license, it's touted as kind of the best thing since sliced bread, the market share goes up, and then shock horror, we found some safety issues, and it plummets, and then gradually it finds its sort of balance in the market. Now that's recognised, you know it's going to happen. It happens every time. What the companies have to do is at the point of licensing, they have to have an explicit risk minimisation plan and risk management plan that says these are the studies we're going to do. And in some cases, it may be specialised randomised trials. In some cases, it may be patient surveillance, patient registers. But there is a planned activity which has to be agreed to as part of the licensing process. So the idea is that that is a managed process. And, it's not perfect, and there's a question like other post-marketing commitments as to how much of it gets stuck to. But it is such a more sensible way of going about looking things than this kind of rocking from optimism to pessimism as if, nobody could have seen this coming. So I think for me, at the European level, that's been really helpful. And suddenly, of course, those with an epidemiological background can using all those skills as well, because actually the thinking about how you look at safety once it's on the marketplace where it's being used more widely in the populations you need to know about is a really, really difficult challenge. Another area which you didn't touch on and is close to my heart and it's linked to that and it's being handled in the same sort of way is paediatrics. I mean, most drugs are licensed in adults because that's where the market is. And then the poor paediatricians, something like 70% of drugs in children are used off-licence. And, paediatricians are trying to work out, well, how do we scale down the dose? Is it by body size? Do the organs handle it in the same way? There's all sorts of technical issues that mean it's not straightforward. And, trying to get the pharmaceutical industry's licence in children, they're on a hide into nothing, so they don't bother. They know that the drug's going to get used. But, again, putting in every drug now has to have a paediatric development plan. And clearly, if it's Viagra, you can say this is not relevant in children. That's fine, yeah, I mean, it's not entirely silly. But they have to make a reasoned case as to what the usage is like to be in children and what their plan is for investigating it. And again, you know, what the teeth are to make sure that actually happens. Yeah, I can't see something being withdrawn from the adult market just because the company didn't deliver, but it's changing the culture, and there's other initiatives which have tried to address that. So that's something I feel very strongly about, because it's, yeah, again, it needs planning through. Accelerated approvals, I'm absolutely with you. I'm the one sitting there saying, and you know, in principle it's there, but the UK tends to go quite hard and say, actually, we want to see some proper data, thank you very much. Surrogate endpoints can be biased. I mean, they just don't give you what you want to know. So I am very resistant to that. You know, that people have ways of getting these drugs without actually giving accelerated approval anyway. I think that one of the huge changes going on is that drug regulation is becoming much more transparent. When I started, it was under the Official Secrets Act. You know, you couldn't say anything about it, whereas now, I mean, it may not be perfect, but we are working in the public domain. Transparency becoming much, much more important, which is an entirely positive move. And I think things like NICE have shifted that. And what it means is that things like risk-benefit are coming right up the agenda. So whereas before it's a question, well, the drug seems to work, the safety doesn't look too bad, we'll give it a license, but it's a bit of the risk-benefit is a bit of this. Both in the FDA, in the EMEA, DIA meetings, what everyone is suddenly talking about is proper assessment of risk and benefit. Do we formalise it? How do we weigh these things up? And I'm involved in, so two examples, you know, natalizumab, which is multiple sclerosis, tremendous impact on MS, but a really nasty side effect of rare brain disease, which more or less had it withdrawn from the market to start with. And then the patient said, hang on a minute, actually, we will take that risk. Or at least, you know, if you tell us about it, we can weigh up for ourselves whether we're prepared to take that risk to have a decent chance of having some efficacy on this, you know, very distressing condition. And so that was reinstated. So very interesting informed debate on risk-benefit there. I was checking my iPhone to check it was public domain, but certainly another drug withdrawal announced in the past few hours, sibutramine, which is called Reductil for obesity, has just been withdrawn in the UK and I think is about to be withdrawn in Europe. So, yeah, we want to get obesity down because that puts us at risk of heart disease. So if you've got a drug that gives you an excess risk of heart attacks and strokes, that's not too bright. So that one's coming off. I mean, none of these drugs work terribly well. So, but again, how do you weigh that up? I mean, the company are saying with great respect they beg to differ, but they'll stick by the rules. I don't know what patients would think of that. I mean, I have my own views that healthy diet is a far better way of handling these things than drugs. But yeah, all of these things are quite difficult risk-benefit, and so trying to find frameworks, ways of expressing that, the MEA would like, you know, they'd be really interested on having things on their website that help patients actually weigh these things up. So that raises all sorts of issues. I've involved in a big European project under the Innovative Medicines Initiative, which is the largest public-private partnership. So it's like FP7, which is European money, but with matching money from pharma. And so suddenly we're in a research project led by the EMEA, and we won the bid on this one, with 29 partners around the table talking about risk-benefit methods for doing it, but with, you know, pharmaceutical partners as well as the EMEA. I think it's incredibly positive, and we've got patient groups there all having a discussion about how we do this, working up case studies. There are some people who think this is dreadful that the EMEA are talking to industry, and then on another day, those same industry people are going to regulate drugs. So, I mean, Stephen Evans feels very strongly that this is a very inappropriate model. So all sorts of tensions in trying to solve the risk-benefit question. I mean, that's one example. But, you know, should regulators, pharma, patients be kind of in the same room threshing these things out? Technical challenges. You know, Bayesians have been telling us how to do it for donkey's years. You know, has that got a role to play? How do we put these things across graphically? So huge, exciting debate coming from, which comes from this greater move to transparency. And it's great saying it should be transparent, but if you don't do it in a way where people can actually understand what the risk benefits is, where that data came from, burrow down to whatever level that you want, then you may as well not do it. So actually, when you can do it, I think, you know, for academics, it's actually, you know, enormously interesting. So that's sort of touching on some of your main frameworks. Just a couple of general points. One is that, however, whatever the problems of pharmaceutical regulation, it's a model of excellence when you start to think about any other areas of medicine. You know, you look at surgery or radiotherapy or any of those. Where are the checks and balances in the system? Let alone, I mean, if you go into education or criminal justice, there is just no framework, and the very existence of drug regulation means that companies have to do studies, and so we have that risk-benefit debate, and put, you know, even if the data is sparse, at least we've got some, whereas without that framework, we just, you know, we are a million miles behind in other areas, so I think there's a lot of real positives about it. But there's some areas where it really doesn't do the job at all, and I don't know whose responsibility it is. And essentially, these come into preventive medicine. And typically what happens is that a drug gets put on the market for some acute clinical condition, and then it gradually finds its way back up the food chain. So something like statins now, you know, is being routinely prescribed for a lot of... My ex-colleague Nick Ward would say that every man over 50, every woman over 55 should be taking the poly pill, which got statins and all sorts of other things in. Breast cancer drugs start off being used for treatment, and my previous colleague Jack Cusick is doing chemo prevention studies and found exactly the same issue, which is who funds those studies, because typically they are going much wider at the point of coming off patent, and so the companies sometimes want to do the studies because of the market, but often lose interest in these more public health uses of them. And so it's the same issue as the head-to-head studies. They're the ones that we want to know about. They're the ones that as patients, public, NICE, need. And yet they're not the ones the companies have a vested interest in doing. And some people here have heard me talk about folic acid in the past, where there's a serious question about whether it's at the right dose. I mean, there is a strong argument based on data synthesis that the recommended dose for most women should be 5 milligrams, not 0.4 milligrams. Be that as it may, whose job is it in a market with sort of 22 generic companies to go away and do those clinical studies and take it to the regulator and put it through? And the answer is it's nobody's, so it's not happening. And so arguably it's a public health scandal that every woman, every pregnant woman is being given a dose that is useful, but it's nowhere as useful as it could be. So I think those are areas, and drug regulation isn't going to solve it. They're sort of wider things, but it's... As a drug regulator, that sort of it's kind of what it's not doing that actually maybe we start worrying about, as well as kind of saying, oh, it's not doing it quite as well as it should. So lots of things. I hope that you've followed at least some of those strands, because lost in 10 minutes. But anyway, thank you for a very stimulating talk.
Thank you.